longer be able to say we can do whatever we like because we were a nation subjected to genocide. You cannot continue to use this argument following the mass killing of another group. I hope, and I write that too, I hope that future generations of Israelis who will not be clean of that stain will remain, but will at least be liberated from this shadow of the Holocaust and will start to look at reality as it is and start to think of how can they reconstitute their own nation, not as a response to the genocide against the Jews, as a response to the Holocaust, but rather as a nation that knows how to share this land where 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians live side by side between the Jordan and the sea, to share it with them with equality and dignity and not with the use of bombs and violence.
Can you talk about this plan to make build a so-called humanitarian city? The defense minister Israel Katz has proposed this idea on the rubble of Rafah. And the opposition of two former prime ministers, you have Ehud Olmert, you have Yair Lapid, they're saying if there is no exit, this is a concentration camp. The significance of these men saying this?
Well, I think it's very important that Lapid, who is being sort of on all parts of this debate, said something, and that Olmert spoke out, although Olmert no longer has any political power in Israel. The plan itself, again, using the typical euphemisms that are used by organizations and states that carry out such crimes, calling that a humanitarian city, which would be a vast concentration camp, a sort of combination of ghetto and concentration camp, that would be built, as you said, on the ruins of Rafah. Rafah has been completely destroyed. There's nothing there. Build a tent city on top of it, bring in initially 600,000 people who would be brought back from the Mawasi area, from the beach area, to which they were displaced when the IDF went in to destroy Rafah, and close them there. The plan does not say that Israel would supply them with any humanitarian assistance in the camp, but some other international organizations yet to be determined, but they would not be able to leave unless they leave the Gaza Strip altogether. So this is, and in continuation to that, the rest of the population is supposed to then join this camp with the goal of removing them. So this is extraordinary that the state of Israel publicly is speaking about the creation of a vast concentration camp whose goal is removal of the population to countries that have unanimously said they are not going to take them in.
Well, Professor Bakhtov, I want to ask about the U.S.'s position on this. Of course, their continuing support for Israel, which has enabled the assault to continue. I want to go back to the former President Biden, his administration, the State Department spokesperson at the time, Matt Miller, who admitted earlier this year in May that he believes Israel committed war crimes in Gaza. This reversal came after more than a year as the face of the Biden administration's foreign policy, repeatedly defending Israel against allegations of war crimes and genocide. This was Miller speaking earlier this year, last year.
We have been very clear that we want to see Israel do everything it can to minimize civilian casualties. We have made clear that they need to operate at all times in full compliance with international humanitarian law. At the same time, we are committed to Israel's right to self-defense.
But during an interview with Sky News last month in June, Matt Miller says he believes Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza and that Israeli soldiers are not being held accountable.
I don't think it's a genocide, but I think it is without a doubt true that Israel has committed war crimes.
You wouldn't have said that at the podium.
Yeah, look, because when you're at the podium, you're not expressing your personal opinion. You're expressing the conclusions of the United States government.
So, Professor Bakhtov, your response to that and also your perception of how the Trump administration has both broken with and continued Biden's policies on Gaza.
Well, you know, in November 2023, I published an op-ed in the New York Times in which I said that war crimes and crimes against humanity were clearly happening in Gaza, and that if this continued, it would become a genocidal operation. I was hoping at the time that someone in the administration would actually pay attention, because the United States in November or December 2023 could have stopped all of this. It was not very difficult to do. Israel cannot act as it has without constant supply of arms from the United States and Germany. These are the two major suppliers. The U.S. supplies between 70% and 80% of all munitions to Israel, and without diplomatic cover. Israel has a diplomatic iron dome created by the U.S. veto in the Security Council. That did not happen. And of course, the evidence was there. And so, first of all, one has to say that the Biden administration is complicit in what happened in Gaza. Secondly, when Trump came in, curiously, the first thing that happened the day before he came into office was that he forced a ceasefire on Israel. And that ceasefire in January this year made it possible to exchange Palestinian prisoners for a large number of hostages, but not all of them. The plan was to complete that exchange and to stop the fighting. But in March, Israel unilaterally broke that ceasefire without any interference from the United States, and since then has continued. And what is particularly galling is the fact that when Trump floated his plan, if you recall that the population of Gaza would be removed and then Gaza would be made into a beautiful resort area, he later on didn't really repeat that. But in Israel, that was seen as license to do exactly what is being done now, that is using hundreds of bulldozers, engineers, explosives, to systematically destroy every building in Gaza so that nobody would be able to live in that area, and then, well, maybe turn it into a resort area, or more likely be an area for Jewish settlers.
I wanted to name names here that you do in your piece. In November, a little more than a year into the war, the Israeli genocide scholar Shmuel Lederman joined the growing chorus of opinion that Israel was engaged in genocidal actions. The Canadian international lawyer William Shabbas came to the same conclusion and has recently described Israel's military campaign in Gaza as absolutely a genocide. Other genocide experts like Melanie O'Brien, president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars, and the British specialist Martin Shaw, who's also said Hamas attack was genocidal, have reached the same conclusions, while the Australian scholar A. Dirk Moses and City University of New York described these events in the Dutch publication NRC as a mix of genocidal and military logic. In the same article, Uger Emmet Ungur, a professor at the Amsterdam-based NIOD Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies, said, "There are probably scholars who still do not think it's genocide, but I don't know them." Professor Bartov, as we begin to wrap up, can you talk about this consensus and whether Holocaust museums, which often address a number of Holocausts, will be taking on what Israel has done in Gaza?
Well, so as I said before, I think there is a growing consensus among genocide scholars and legal experts. William Shabbas is a very good example, because he's a highly respected expert. He's very conservative. He took a long time to reach that conclusion, and he has. I just spoke with him recently in Europe, and he very strongly believes that what Israel is doing now is genocide. But the other side of it, as you indicate, is the tragedy that most Holocaust scholars and all of the institutions that I know that are dedicated to commemorating and researching the Holocaust have refused to say anything. And some, again, a minority of Holocaust scholars, have come out and claimed that genocide scholars speaking about genocide in Gaza are anti-Semitic. that this is an anti-Semitic argument. And that use of the term anti-Semitism, which, as you know, of course, that we spoke about, was also a tool to silence any protest last spring on American campuses. This abuse of the term is now creating a rift between Holocaust scholars and genocide scholars. And what I fear, and that's what I write at the end of this piece, what I fear is that this will mean that the Holocaust, which has had come over decades to be recognized as an event of universal importance, as an event that we have to learn from, because of the silence, because of the betrayal of the notion of never again by these institutions and these scholars, will go back to become a sort of ethnic enclave, only something that the Jews talk about among themselves.
Omer Bartov, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University and an Israeli-American scholar described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists in the subject of genocide. His forthcoming book, Israel, What Went Wrong? His previous books, Genocide, the Holocaust, and Israel-Palestine. We'll link to your piece in the New York Times. I'm a genocide scholar. I know it when I see it. Up next, Adam Schatz. Stay with us. Weston playing the blues for Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Syria's interim president, Ahmad al-Sharaa, says Israel's targeting of the country's civilian and public institutions in order to undermine the region's stability has been thwarted, for now, with the, quote, intervention of American, Arab, and Turkish mediation, which saved the region from an unknown fate, unquote. President Sharaa made the comment as Syrian forces have withdrawn from the southern city of Soweida after reaching a ceasefire deal with armed groups in the Druze-majority region. The deal seeks to end days of sectarian violence exacerbated by Israeli attacks on Syrian forces in Soweida, siding with Druze fighters. On Wednesday, Israeli strikes on Damascus killed three people and blew up part of the Syrian Defense Ministry and a facility near the presidential palace. President Sharaa responded in a televised speech today.
Israel, which has been targeting our stability and creating discord among us since the fall of the former regime, is now seeking to once again transform our pure land into an arena of endless chaos. It seeks to dismantle the unity of our people and weaken our ability to move forward in the process of reconstruction and plunder.
Elsewhere in the region, President Trump said Wednesday that Iran wants to, quote, negotiate badly, but we're in no rush, after Israel and the U.S. struck Iran's nuclear facilities last month. Iranian leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Wednesday the country is ready to respond to any new military attacks.
For more, we're joined here in New York by Adam Schatz, U.S. editor of the London Review of Books. He has a new piece, The World Since October 7th. His latest book is The Rebel's Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Frantz Fanon. He's reported from Palestine, Lebanon, Algeria, Egypt, and beyond. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You have a great beginning to this piece, a very provocative paragraph. On June 18th, the sixth day of Israel's attack on Iran, David Petraeus gave some unsolicited advice to Donald Trump in an interview with the New York Times. Trump, he said, should deliver an ultimatum to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, ordering him to dismantle Iran's uranium enrichment enrichment program or face the complete destruction of your country and your regime and your people. If Khamenei were to refuse, he added, that improves our legitimacy, and then reluctantly we blow them to smithereens. You say that Petraeus was recommending Iran, a country of 90 million people, be reduced to Gaza-like conditions, hardly occasioned comment. Murderous threats with U.S. officials against foreign leaders and their people and no longer provoke shock, much less condemnation. They're simply part of the conversation about how the U.S. should manage its empire. Why don't you take it from there?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here and an honor to follow the great historian Omer Bartov. What I meant to underscore with that paragraph is that this kind of rhetoric has become utterly banal, and it's not simply Trump and the far right who speak blithely about overthrowing foreign governments, about bombing other foreign populations. It's people who have a reputation in the States for being liberals and moderates. David Petraeus was a darling of liberal intellectuals, you'll recall, and he speaks very cavalierly about what is an offensive war, a war of aggression, an unprovoked war against another nation. And I think that this does reflect a kind of shift in American political culture. Obviously, American foreign policy has been very violent. I mean, Vietnam, the wars in support of the death squads in Latin America in the 1980s, the Iraq War of 2003. But this this normalization of this kind of rhetoric does seem striking to me. And the fact that we can talk about a war of aggression against Iran because of its supposed nuclear weapons program without talking about the fact that there is a country in the Middle East which does possess a major nuclear facility, although we don't talk about it, Dimona, which is the state of Israel. It's simply not a part of the discussion.
So if you could say, Adam, you do talk in the piece about what you think was the ultimate rationale, both of the Israeli and then U.S. strikes on Iran, and what the impact of those strikes has been on the reform movement in Iran, because there was quite a vibrant, and is, opposition for many, many years, different movements that have come together in opposition to the regime.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's important to recall that that 10 years ago, in 2015, there was the Iranian nuclear agreement signed by Iran, by countries of the EU, by the United States, the Joint Comprehensive Agreement. And 3 years later, Donald Trump decided to withdraw from it, even though, by all accounts, the agreement was working. So there was a diplomatic option for ensuring that Iran's nuclear enrichment program would be directed to peaceful ends. You know, in my view, the attack on Iran was a war of opportunity. After Israel decapitated the leadership of Hezbollah last fall, in a sense, a war with Iran was almost a foregone conclusion because Hezbollah had provided a kind of shield, a bulwark against a potential Israeli strike. And in fact, arguably, the attack on Iran was modeled on the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon in October of 2024, which led, of course, to the assassination of Hezbollah's general secretary Hassan Nasrallah. I think that the primary motivation for attacking Iran has to do with Israel's determination to settle accounts with any force in the region that might challenge its domination, that might provide support for Palestinian organizations resisting the occupation. And Iran had relationships with Hamas and with Islamic Jihad. I think that was a much more important factor than its uranium enrichment program.
And what do you think, Adam? I mean, because, you know, the American strikes also ostensibly, I mean, they did attack three nuclear enrichment sites in Iran. But according to a recent U.S. assessment, which was just reported today by NBC, in these strikes, only one of the three nuclear enrichment strikes was mostly destroyed, setting work there back significantly. But the two others were not as badly damaged, which raises the question of whether there will be additional strikes, either by Israel or the U.S.
Well, the Israelis have threatened to carry out additional strikes. And it's possible that they, in fact, prefer this arrangement, where the merest sign of an Iranian effort to enrich uranium beyond acceptable levels or to pursue a weapon will be met with further Israeli attacks. This situation may be preferable to the Israelis to any kind of diplomatic agreement. And just to return to the question that you raised earlier about the Iranian reform movement, during Israel's attack on Iran, Benjamin Netanyahu made a public appeal, a video appeal to the Iranian people, claiming that Israel was a kind of liberating force and urging Iranians to overthrow the regime. There was even talk, of course, about assassinating the supreme leader, Khamenei. In the initial hours, perhaps even days, of Israel's attack, there were Iranians inside Iran who were pleased that certain members of Iran's leadership, of the Revolutionary Guard, were killed in targeted strikes because there is tremendous discontent in Iran. The regime is widely hated. But when it became clear that Israel's campaign was extremely violent, was indiscriminate, and that hundreds of people, and eventually probably about 1,000 people, were to be killed in attacks in civilian neighborhoods, Iranians concluded that they had no wish to be liberated by Israel, by a state that, moreover, has been committing genocide in Gaza. And I think that perhaps the attack that most alarmed and disturbed Iranians was the attack on Evin Prison. I mean, the idea that Israel was attacking the very people who had suffered most under the Iranian regime.
So, Adam, I want to go. I mean, let's talk more about, you know, what precisely Israel has been doing in Gaza and, you know, the regional implications that you've just spoken of. But one of the things that you mentioned in the piece that is very interesting, which is the rise of organized crime in Gaza, encouraged by Israel. You quote Netanyahu as saying, quote, "We activated clans in Gaza that oppose Hamas. What's wrong with that?" he said. You write in your piece, quote, "As much as forced displacement, killing, starvation, and humiliation, the promotion of criminality of a lawless gray zone of the kind evoked by Primo Levi, in which members of a persecuted group are enlisted to police, brutalize, and at times kill their own, has become a defining feature of Israel's rule inside Gaza." The reference to the gray zone by Primo Levi is, of course, from his collection of essays, The Drowned and the Saved, which is, in fact, an account of his time in Auschwitz. So, you know, this is not something that we hear about very often, what is happening by Palestinians to Palestinians under Israeli, I don't know what you would call it, a coercion, much like as Primo Levi, you make the comparison, gray zone. In Auschwitz, the Nazis made the Jews do to one another what the Nazis were doing also to the Jews.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to see that the lawlessness in Gaza today is not— This is not a state of nature. This is something that is encouraged and promoted by the Israelis. As you just noted, Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly defended this policy of supporting this criminal clan, essentially a kind of mafia organization, a racket, which has been involved in cross-border smuggling and is said to have ties to the Islamic State. And this, of course, falls into a long pattern of Israel providing support to any group that might be undermining its immediate antagonist in the Palestinian national camp. And so in this case, to weaken Hamas, they're going to support this local thug. And of course, the appearance of criminality and lawlessness ends up reinforcing the impression in the mainstream that Palestinians in Gaza are a lawless people. In fact, they're suffering from a lawlessness, which is an effect of specific policies, which is an effect, in a sense, of a tyranny imposed on them. I don't mean to suggest that that the situation in Gaza is the same as the Auschwitz described by Primo Levi in his great book, but there are disturbing echoes.
So I want to talk about the smear of anti-Semitism against those who raise what's going on in Gaza, for example. You quote Mark Mazower saying no one wanted to be called an anti-Semite. This was after October 7th. And yet, if you believe the pundits, anti-Semites were everywhere, and it sounded like Manhattan was Berlin on the eve of Kristallnacht. You say that previously the fight against anti-Semitism was a left liberal cause. How do you trace the trajectory from that moment to this one, when those leading the crusade against anti-Semitism are very much on the right, and the appeal of Israel to places like, well, the far right in France and Hungary and other places?
Not only are they on the right, Amy, but these are people who often themselves make highly anti-Semitic statements and who consort with notorious anti-Semites like Nick Fuentes and Kanye West. And somehow, very shamelessly, they get away with it. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, I think this has historical roots. This began, really, in the 1970s when pro-Israel organizations and writers began to promote the idea of a new anti-Semitism, by which they meant criticism of Israel. And there was a campaign to equate any criticism of Israel's policies, of the occupation, of Israel's expansionist wars, to equate this with hatred of the Jewish people, and to smear criticism of Israel and anti-Zionism as inherently anti-Semitic. So this has deep historical roots, but clearly it's been on steroids in the last decade or so. And far-right organizations and leaders, I think, have found that that by weaponizing the charge of anti-Semitism, it's much easier to weaken the institutions that they already despise, those institutions being the university, democracy, immigration, for example. Anti-Semitism has become an incredibly potent tool to dismantle what remains of U.S. democracy. And we see far-right organizations in Europe which have drawn inspiration. Of course, there's a lot of overlap between these groups. There is a kind of right-wing international. But I think what we also have to emphasize is that there is a deep attraction on the part of far-right leaders and movements to Israel as a state, because Israel is an ethno-national state based on racial exclusion, based on policies of oppression, of dispossession, of apartheid. And for that reason, Israel has a strong appeal to these right-wing organizations, right, and leaders who love deportations, who love building walls. Israel is seen as a kind of model.
Well, Adam Schatz, we thank you so much for being with us, U.S. editor of the London Review of Books. We'll link to your piece, your latest one, The World Since October 7th. And we're going to have you back to talk about your book, The Rebels Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Franz Fanon. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.